Welcome to New World Notes, edited by Kenneth Doust. Today we'll hear part one of a documentary on how the big oil companies pretty much came to rule the world. It's called The Secret of the Seven Sisters. I hope you'll stay tuned. This is a story about the Seven Sisters, which is to say, big oil. The term Seven Sisters was coined in the 1950s. It referred to the Anglo-American cartel that controlled the large majority of the world's oil, including all the oil in the Middle East. The Seven Sisters were five big American companies, plus Royal Dutch Shell and the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, now BP. Because of industry mergers, the original Seven Sisters are now four: ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, and BP. They don't have quite the power or the global monopoly they did 50 years ago, but they are still more powerful than any government in the West, especially the United States. Which is why the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has just reached the catastrophic level of 400 parts per million, and the speed of global warming is rapidly increasing, and there has been no move by anyone in government to reduce our burning of fossil fuels. It's why BP could do catastrophic damage to the Gulf of Mexico and our southern states and receive for its crimes only the mildest slap on the wrist. Or was it a kiss? The power of big oil is why Obama will approve the Keystone XL pipeline, the environment be damned. It is why the U.S. Army and CIA are now all over the oil-rich parts of Africa. It is why the U.S. destroyed Iraq, except its oil industry, and why we are fighting to conquer Afghanistan, and why the United States has oil-rich Iran and oil-rich Venezuela in its sights. Remember Gaddafi of Libya? Did I mention that Libya has lots of oil? Why do you think Hitler sent Rommel there to conquer the place? Did you know that Somalia has lots of oil? Don't get me started. There's a good new video documentary out called The Secret of the Seven Sisters. The first part of it is especially relevant to America today. It focuses on our control of the Middle East, and it's a wonderful quick refresher course in 20th century history. This is history that the ruling elite does not want us old folks to remember, and does not want the young folks to know in the first place. And so far, they've pretty much gotten their wish. The film is about how big oil came to control or even own all the oil in the Middle East. They got it by massively bribing the country's corrupt kings. They gave both huge bribes of money and the promise that the British and United States governments would keep their corrupt ruling families in power. The Saud dynasty in Arabia, the Pahlavi dynasty in Iran. The film is also about how the peoples of the Middle East, and even the democratic governments of the Middle East, tried to regain some control over their own country's mineral wealth, tried to wrestle some oil profits away from the Seven Sisters, and use them to benefit their own country. And the film is about how, time after time, the United States overthrew those democratic governments in the Middle East and established brutal dictatorships in their place. Next time you hear our president or secretary of state prattle about the U.S.'s great support for democracy worldwide, I hope you'll recall that in the 1950s, Iraq had a democratic government. The democratic government threatened to reduce the profits of big oil. The United States overthrew the democracy in Iraq and put the dictator Saddam Hussein into power, and kept him in power for a half century. In the 1950s, Iran had a democratic government which threatened the profits of big oil. At BP's request, the United States overthrew Iran's democracy and made Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi dictator of Iran. and then snatched much of Iran's oil away from BP and gave it to the U.S.-based big oil companies. Gave it to those sisters whose maiden name had been Rockefeller. As for Saudi Arabia, they never had a democracy, and the U.S. has helped the ruling family keep it that way. So, on to the documentary. The title is The Secret of the Seven Sisters, Part 1, Desert Storms. The part of that we'll hear today will take us from the founding of the big oil cartel in 1928 to the creation of OPEC in 1960. It starts with a prologue. The reporter is traveling by car in oil-rich Iraq today. His Iraqi driver is having a hard time finding gasoline for sale. Wherever Iraq's oil may be going, it's apparently no longer going to the Iraqis.
Iraq, Iran, and Kuwait. This documentary is on the trail of the Seven Sisters cartel. The investigation leads to Kirkuk in northern Iraq. It's 50 degrees in the shade. There are endless checkpoints and controls. The war has left its mark. In the heart of the Middle East, Iraq, one of the latest battlefields in the Great Oil War. This old American taxi is a gas guzzler, constantly hungry for fuel. The driver seeks out the local petrol peddlers. In oil-rich Iraq, it's not easy filling a tank.
Okay.
Who is responsible for that? With multiple attacks and kidnappings, insecurity is rife amongst the derricks and wells. The taxi driver, Ali, calls the route to Kirkuk the road to hell. Oil had previously been found in the Middle East, but never in such quantities. In 1927, it gushed from the ground in Kirkuk. The violence of the discharge caused 5 casualties. Iraq's oil was already wreaking its wrath. But the real story, the secret story of oil, begins elsewhere. In Scotland, in the heart of the Highlands, on August 28, 1928, in Achnacarry Castle. 3 men have an appointment here, a Dutchman, an American, and an Englishman. This pheasant and grouse hunt was never filmed. There are no photos or archive records, but this is probably how it happened. The Dutchman is Henry Detterding, an implacable and determined man, nicknamed the Napoleon of Oil. Having exploited a find in Sumatra, he joined forces with a rich ship owner and painted shell salesman. The 2 men founded Royal Dutch Shell. The American is Walter C. Teagle. He represents the Standard Oil Company, founded by John D. Rockefeller at the age of 31. The future Exxon. Wells, transport, refining and distribution, everything is controlled by Standard, an omnipotent, many-headed beast. In 1911, Rockefeller was ordered to dismantle his trust and form 34 separate companies. And yet they all remained under the control of the century's first billionaire. The Englishman, Sir John Cadman, director of the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, soon to become BP. On the initiative of the brilliant young First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill, the British government took a stake in BP, and the Royal Navy switched from coal to oil. The First World War would validate this decision. With fuel-hungry ships, planes, and tanks, oil became the blood of every battle. The new automobile industry was developing fast, and the Ford T was selling by the million. The world was thirsty for oil, and companies were waging a merciless contest. But but the competition was making the market unstable. It was time to reach an agreement. Their names are Royal Dutch Shell, Standard Oil, and the Anglo-Persian Oil Company. Today, Shell, Exxon, and BP, the biggest oil companies in the world. Back at the castle, the leading lights of the oil trade are seated, and their secret meeting can begin. Henry Detterding declares, "It is time to exploit, fraternally and to the greatest profit, the world's oil resources. Production zones, transport costs, sale prices, everything must be agreed and shared." In the early hours, an agreement is reached. A secret pact is sealed, but with no signatures. The great oil cartel can prepare to dominate the world.
1928, c'est le moment où, en effet, les compagnies pétrolières, les grandes
compagnies. In 1928, the great oil companies decided, through the Aknekari agreements, to share oil prices and production zones by forming a cartel. The countries were kept in the dark, as were their governments and the producing countries. It was all done in the greatest secrecy and amorality. We'd have to wait until the early 1950s for the details of the agreement finally to leak out. Journalist Eric Laurent.
Pour que le détail de ces accords puisse enfin commencer à filtrer.
On this morning of August 29, 1928, the world order has changed. Other companies would join the billionaires' conspiracy. History will call them the Seven Sisters: Exxon, Shell, BP, Mobil, Texaco, Gulf, and Chevron. The story of the Seven Sisters takes us to Tehran. In the early 20th century, the oil companies fought bitterly here to control Persia's vast oil assets. At the end of the First World War, through the Sykes-Picot agreements, then the Treaty of San Remo, France and Britain divided up the Middle East. The American oil companies were enraged. What could be done? The solution came from an Armenian, Korlats Gulbenkian, the greatest oil broker of all time. Gulbenkian drew a red line tracing the perimeters of future oil extraction zones, forbidding competition and demanding mutual assistance within the red line area. The Iraq Petroleum Company was created. BP, Shell, Exxon, and the French SFP, the future Total, were equal shareholders. The Seven Sisters controlled the Middle East's known oil reserves. Gulbenkian claimed 5% of every contract.
Pierre Terzian, Director, Petrostrategies.
Les contrats de concession, qui étaient de petits textes.
The contracts were short, only 15 or 20 pages. Through them, the states conceded almost all their territory. How ignorant they were to do such a thing. These oil people bought up whole countries, or at least their resources, with documents barely 15 to 20 pages long.
For the British, the Abadan refinery in Iran was the jewel in the crown, the biggest refinery in the world. The Iranians never had access to the company's accounts. The royalties paid to the Iranian state were negligible, but sufficient to satisfy the reigning monarch, Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi, and by his silence. The Anglo-Persian was a state within a state, where the law and the lifestyle were consummately British. The Seven Sisters ruled over the Middle East and its oil. Oil which had to flow with no interruption towards Europe and the United States.
Professor Michael Clare of Hampshire College.
Delivery of oil to the public is a crucial requirement of any person who wants to remain in office. And one has to understand the importance of oil to the American way of life to understand why politicians see their job as, in large part, if they're in foreign policy, is in procuring adequate supplies of oil to meet American needs. It explains why President Roosevelt, in his last months when he was ailing, felt it necessary to meet with the king of Saudi Arabia, Abdulaziz ibn Saud.
Oil requirements were ever increasing. On his way back from the Yalta conference on February 14, 1945, President Roosevelt anchored his ship, the USS Quincy, near the Suez Canal. He had a meeting with the King of Arabia, Abdulaziz ibn Saud. Nothing would be signed, but they reconvened an agreement made in 1936, opening the doors of the Kingdom of Arabia to American oil companies. In exchange for the oil, the king demanded protection for his country and gold, a great deal of gold. The kingdom's fortune was sealed by an English adventurer, Harrison John Filby, a spy, explorer, and writer who'd been entrusted, along with a certain Colonel Lawrence, with organizing the Arab revolt. Having converted to Islam, Filby sided with Ibn Saud against his own country and participated in the creation of the Kingdom of Arabia. In 1936, on his advice, Ibn Saud sold the kingdom's oil rights to the Americans. Aramco was founded, a consortium combining Exxon, Chevron, Mobil, and Texaco.
Sheikh Ahmed Zaki Yamani, Saudi Minister of Petroleum from 1962 to 1986.
All these companies like Aramco in the old days, they were a state within the state. Saudi Arabia cannot have a law controlling Aramco. Aramco has the power to produce the oil, to export the oil at the price they decide. Saudi Arabia has no power except to raise their hands to get the money they give them. And this was the relationship.
Arabian oil production began in 1946, shortly after the meeting between Roosevelt and Ibn Saud. 20,000 Americans were billeted to Dahran in eastern Arabia. In theory, the oil men were merely the king's guests, as no one could purchase the Prophet's holy lands. But in fact, Aramco set the rules for the king, its greatest ally. The American company's only obligation was to shower the king and his 3,000 princes with gold. The desert's oil resources proved to be fabulous, the greatest treasure trove of all time. The United States and Saudi Arabia were wedded, for better or for worse, oil and dollars. Despite the ensuing crises, there has been no divorce. It was here in Washington in 1952 that the Seven Sisters Cartel was summoned to face the Supreme Court for the first time. The Federal Trade Commission was investigating their commercial practices and illicit arrangements. President Harry Truman received a confidential memo from Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI, but the investigation was blocked. The trial would never take place. What was good for the Seven Sisters was good for America. In Tehran, the bazaar is the heart and pulse of the Iranian capital. It was here in 1951 that the first revolt against British petroleum began. The bazaaris, the middle classes, the Tudor party communists, and Shia religious leaders took to the streets. Their action was triggered by BP's refusal to meet improved wage claims. The workers launched a strike which paralyzed Abadan, the huge oil terminal.
This was absolutely crucial source of wealth to what remained of the British Empire after World War II.
Michael Clare.
And it was also a symbol of white Anglo-Saxon superiority. And the histories of the time make it very clear that for the British, the Iranians were viewed as third-class citizens, as if they were black.
An uprising was sparked. A nationalist MP, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, was the movement's leader. In Parliament, he was known as Mossadegh al-Saltaneh, a man of proven honesty. His program was simple: nationalize the oil.
Farabord's Reis Dana, historian. Dr. Mossadegh was accused of radicalism, which of course isn't true. He had identified the central problem: recovering the oil that had been confiscated.
Under pressure from Parliament, the Shah appointed Mossadegh Prime Minister. On the very next day, May 1, 1951, Mossadegh led the vote for the nationalization of Iran's oil. The army occupied the oil fields, but the Iranians were not qualified to keep operations going. 3,000 British technicians and their families left the country, and the British Navy blockaded the ports.
Pierre Terzian. There was extraordinary pandemonium around the world. The Western countries declared Iranian petrol off-limits. Anyone buying Iranian oil would be taken to court. So Iran could no longer sell its oil to anyone. Any tankers leaving Iranian ports were seized.
Iran and Dr. Mossadegh had to be punished. The British Prime Minister Winston Churchill asked the Americans to help. The CIA stepped in. Countless dollars were distributed to pay off members of Parliament and leading army officers. The coup d'etat operation was given the codename Ajax. It was coordinated by Kermit Roosevelt, the president's nephew and a CIA agent.
There was a military coup. Democrat generals, communists and nationalists were shot. Dr. Mossadegh was sent into exile. Iran was submerged with fear, and the oil companies regained their old power.
Five 5,000 of the coup's opponents were shot and killed. Mossadegh was arrested and sentenced to death, a sentence later reduced to exile. On August 24, 1953, the monarch, Reza Shah, returned in triumph. Having organized the coup d'etat, the Americans claimed their reward. BP had to make way for the US companies. Now present in both Iran and Saudi Arabia, the USA controlled two of the planet's biggest black gold producers.
It was common practice. The fact that the CIA intervened in Iran to establish foreign oil companies is not unusual for that time. The American oil companies are so powerful that they can easily choose to make or break a government. What is exceptional is that one man stood up, Mossadegh, and it resulted in failure. That had a major effect. For several years, no one dared to move a muscle.
The shockwave created by Mossadegh did move towards Suez, however. Egypt had never benefited from the huge revenues generated by the canal, shared by France and Britain. On July 26, 1956, President Nasser declared the nationalization of the canal. A British, French, and Israeli coalition attacked Egypt. Port Said at the entrance to the canal was bombarded and Egyptian forces crushed. Nasser sunk concrete-laden ships in the canal and all traffic was blocked. Under American and Soviet pressure, the Anglo-French forces were forced to withdraw. For Nasser, a military defeat became a political victory. Nasserism and Arab nationalism were born on the banks of the Suez Canal.
The nationalization of the Suez Canal, unlike the oil in Iran, was a success. That had a profound effect. It showed it was possible to succeed, to oppose the Western countries, and in certain cases, it could work.
A political victory for the Arab countries, but an economic victory for the oil companies. The closure of the canal led to a substantial rise in crude oil prices, huge profits for the Seven Sisters. The rise enabled them to pay for the building of a new generation of ships, supertankers. And the Cape of Good Hope became the new maritime route for oil transportation. Baghdad, translatable as the Garden of Peace. For the people of this city, there is neither war nor peace. But worse, a living nightmare every day, a life of uncertainty. It was here on the banks of the Tigris that the Seven Sisters would pay for their sins, vanity and greed. The sisters were greedy. Despite the havoc caused by the Suez Crisis, Shell and BP decided to cut the buying price of oil by 9%, under the pretext of overproduction. It was the Seven Sisters' first mistake. On September 10th, 1960, representatives from Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, and Kuwait all met in Baghdad. After 4 days of discussion, they agreed to found OPEC, the Organization of Petrol Exporting Countries. Their objective: to collectively fix the sale price of their oil.
Sheikh Yamani, former Saudi oil minister.
Well, the Western countries did not really feel that this little organization will be powerful. So they ignore it. The oil companies also being very powerful, they ignored it. Not only this, they refuse to mention the word OPEC. And I know for sure that America was working very hard to convince some countries in the Gulf not to join this, including Saudi Arabia.
And here in 1960, with the creation of OPEC, we'll pause until next week. Note how the cartel of big oil companies finally produced a strong opponent, a cartel of oil-producing countries. The plot thickens, the story continues. Thank you for listening, and please catch the rest next week. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising Illegitimae non carborundum, what goes around comes around, and ciao.